For the week of February 17th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 182, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, getting ready for my Oscar party, I'm Michael Giltz.
Ah, you have an Oscar party. I did not know that. And by the way, where's my invitation again? Maybe I should go check the mail. I can't find it.
Yes, check the mail.
Okay, well, you know, while I'm checking the mail, I didn't really prepare for today's show because I spent the entire weekend on Hulu.
Why was that?
Well, because for some reason, the Criterion Collection this weekend, and I guess it's still up, so I don't, maybe they just left it up for the week. They have all of their collection, all of these like great movies on Hulu.
Available for free to stream.
Yes, although there are commercials interspersed throughout.
So movies that you would normally have to pay to get access to via Hulu Plus for a brief few days were available online for free.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Are
these movies
on Hulu
Plus? Why didn't
you
tell people about this last week so they could watch them?
Because I didn't know about it last week.
Ah.
I don't know if Criterion movies are on Hulu Plus.
Yes, they are.
They are? Then it is.
Yes, they have a rotating supply of movies. They don't have all their collection available. They've released hundreds of movies over the years. But, you know, they have a rotating pile of 20, 30, or 40 movies or more, perhaps, I don't know, that are available on Hulu Plus. And then after a week or a month or whatever, they rotate them out and put in some other movies. Well, what movie did you watch?
I watched some of Eraserhead, David Lynch's first film. And some of Hitchcock's The 39 Steps.
Great movie.
Yeah, both very good movies. But, you know, we probably should begin this week's show by talking about last week's show. And I want to thank whoever this was who called in to our toll-free number, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And this is what they had to say.
Hey, Sperling. There must be something with iTunes or something. The MP3's messed up. So, gosh, we want to hear David, and we want to hear what went on over at the Grammy. So see if you can get that fixed as soon as you can so we don't have to go too long without all your great information. Thanks.
And so I actually went onto iTunes, which I always check to make sure that the episode can be at least seen on iTunes, and it could, and it was in our feed burner feed, and it was downloading in other places, but for some reason it wasn't downloading in iTunes. And this particular listener, and I thank you very much, whoever you are, I wish I had your name, I would thank you by name. I would also like to thank David Knight out of the United Kingdom, who also sent in an email saying the same thing. And I immediately went and tried to figure out what was wrong. I still don't know what it is, but I was able to get it up on iTunes so that it could play and download.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
Yes, I don't know what was going on there. That was a glitch in our feed.
Well, what information will people not be able to download this week from iTunes?
Well, you won't be able to download our conversation with Aaron Rich. Aaron is, of course, he's appeared here on the show regularly over the years. He's a blogger who reviews movies with a strong emphasis on independent and international films. You'll probably hear about a lot of movies that you've never heard of before. We're going to find out about some of his favorite movies from the past year, many of which, as I just mentioned, may be new to some of our listeners. We'll also find out how Universal Music is going to finally start earning some dough for all those cover songs that can be found on YouTube. And Michael is completely baffled by this story, mainly because it makes no sense to begin with. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right. And the number one movie around the world is the latest Die Hard movie. It's A Good Day to Die Hard. The Bruce Willis film made $86 million around the world this weekend. It opened in the U.S. on Wednesday. It opened around the world last weekend. So its worldwide total to date is $113 million. At number two around the world is Identity Theft, the Melissa McCarthy, Jason Bateman comedy. It grossed $23 million. It's open in North America only, and it grossed $70 million to date.
That's actually pretty good for a North American only opening. $70 million in the first week? Not bad.
2 weeks.
First 2 weeks, okay. But,
you know. 2 weekends. Yeah. No, it's doing very well. At number three is Safe Haven, the romantic film starring Josh Duhamel. It grossed $21 million. It's at $30 million and counting thanks to its Wednesday opening. It was sort of neck and neck with Die Hard all weekend long. It was doing quite well for a while. It's directed by Lasse Hallström. What a sad fall that is for Lasse. But anyway.
Well, we should say what Lasse Hallström has directed before. Cider House Rules and many other films.
And My Life as a Dog. Absolutely.
Yes.
At number four is Escape from Planet Earth, an animated film I really don't have any idea what it's about. It grossed $16 million on its opening weekend. At number five is Django Unchained, still making a lot of money around the world. It's at $15 million. It's grossed $365 million to date.
That's actually amazing.
That is. It's a more than triple the budget. So Quentin Tarantino got his biggest budget ever, and he delivered. At number six is the zombie romantic comedy Warm Bodies, another $14 million. It's at $68 million and counting. Nicholas Holt also has Jack the Giant Killer coming up, so it's a big couple of weeks for Nicholas Holt. At number seven, two movies tied at $13 million. Beautiful Creatures was the first in what might have been a series of films based on a young adult novels. It grossed $13 million, and it made $15 million to date. And right below it is Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters. That's the Jeremy Renner film, which is sort of seen as a flop in North America, but it grossed another $13 million over the weekend. It's at $150 million worldwide, so thank you overseas. It costs $50 million to make, and it's tripled that budget once you add in the overseas. So a movie that kind of looks like a flop in North America, if you look at the worldwide picture, is a pretty solid success. And number nine is Wreck-It Ralph, the animated film. It grossed another $12 million. It's at $411 million worldwide, thanks mostly to a big UK bow this weekend.
And Sperling is really rooting for it to win Best Animated Film at the Oscars.
Well, they very well might. I mean, it's competing with Brave. They're both Disney films. They're probably the two frontrunners, but we'll have to see who triumphs.
And this is the Academy calling Michael now to let him know which animated film is in first place.
Yes, they like to give me little tips before I fill up my ballot.
Yes.
At number 10 is Les Mis. It grossed another $11 million. It's getting closer and closer to $400 million worldwide. At number 11 is Lincoln, the Steven Spielberg film, another $8 million. It's at $235 million and counting. At number 12, two movies tied at $7 million. Mama, the Jessica Chastain horror film, and Flight, the Denzel Washington drama. Mama's at $88 million worldwide, and Flight is at $140 million. Then at number 14, three movies tied with $6 million. Side Effects, the swan song for Steven Soderbergh, if we're to believe him. That's at $19 million and counting. Silver Linings Playbook, which is just an inch towards $100 million. It'll hit that this week before the weekend.
Actually, I think it already did in the U.S.
I mean, it is Monday. It hasn't quite done it. It's doing it today.
Okay.
It's doing it today as we speak. It should probably pass it Monday, maybe Tuesday. And then Jack Reacher, the Tom Cruise film, that's at $203 million and counting. Not done yet. They said if it made $250 million, they might make a sequel. So if you're a Jack Reacher fan, keep your fingers crossed. At number 17, Life of Pi, the Ang Lee film, continues just to rake in money. It grossed $5 million, and its total is now $577 million worldwide. Ang Lee has to be one of the most successful directors when it comes to offbeat projects. And at number 18, three movies tied at about $4 million. The other Jessica Chastain film, the Oscar hopeful Zero Dark Thirty, though it's probably going to walk away empty-handed come Oscar night. It's made $110 million to date. Right there with it is Argo, the Ben Affleck film, which has grossed $204 million worldwide and is probably going to trounce Zero Dark Thirty's ass at Oscar night. And right below that is Hotel Transylvania, the animated film, which made just under $4 million. It's at $333 million to date.
It's interesting that you mentioned Argo and Zero Dark Thirty, because last week I said that Argo was the front runner for Best Picture, the Best Picture Oscar. And one of our listeners was on a flight back from the BAFTA Awards, and I don't think I should actually say who it is, but he's a big mucky muck at DreamWorks.
Muckety muck.
Yeah, or what you said. And he said, look, you shouldn't have backed down on saying Argo was the front runner. We're going to lose, you know? And he's, of course, backing Lincoln because it's his studio's film. And he said, there is no way we are winning Best Picture. It would be a huge upset. And when I asked why, he said, look, you know, first off, Ben Affleck has the story this year. He is, you know, he's made a huge career transition from, you know, poster boy to Jennifer Lopez's boyfriend to being completely untouchable to now being this very talented filmmaker and a halfway decent actor. He has the story this year that people are backing. And after the SAG win, there's no way DreamWorks, at least this particular person from DreamWorks, believes that they can win Best Picture. And he felt, you know what, Steven Spielberg, what story does he have? He's a billionaire who gets to do anything he wants. there's really no story there. Daniel Day-Lewis, he felt, you know, certainly will win as best actor.
Well, there you go. That's certainly where things are leading. If we look at the WGA awards, that was just more grist for that mill. Argo won Best Adapted Screenplay, and Zero Dark Thirty won Best Original Screenplay. That's sort of an upset for Argo, beating Tony Kushner, who was the early frontrunner, and could still, of course, triumph at Oscar night. And certainly Ben Affleck won't win for Best Director, because he wasn't nominated. So that may be Steven Spielberg's consolation prize.
Well, that's exactly this executive said, look, Steven Spielberg will likely win Best Director, which is its big award for the evening. It's, you know, it's kind of, hey, congratulations, you made a very good movie.
And Best Actor.
And Best Actor. Here are some two very big awards. You made a great film, and oh, by the way, Argo wins Best Picture. As a way of awarding Ben Affleck, because of course he's listed as a producer for that film. Although this particular executive, who is in the Academy and gets to vote, said, and this is not the only person I've heard this from, voted for the little girl. She's known as the little girl. Nobody can actually remember her name, but they've all voted for the little girl. So depending on how Best Actress goes, it's, you know, everybody thinks that Jessica Chastain and Jennifer Lawrence are kind of in a neck and neck race here.
I don't.
The vote could be split. And
No. Emmanuel Riva will win for Amour. It's an unbelievable performance. It's incredibly memorable. Every Oscar voter is over 50, and they're all moved by this film. It got nominated for Best Picture, writing, screenplay, Best Foreign Film. Didn't it get nominated for Best Director as well?
Yes, it
Michael did. Haneke. Yeah. No, they love this movie, and that performance is the performance you walk away from. It's just heartrending. It's so good, and it's such a flashy performance in a way. It's not, but it is such a – it's subtle, but – it is such a heartrending performance that is going to win Best Actress.
You know, what's interesting to me, at least, is that the Academy members that I've spoken to who have watched Amour, which is in French by the Austrian, as we've mentioned, Michael Haneke, the filmmaker, the Academy members who watched it in a theater like it and they love it. The Academy members that watched it at home on a screener all unanimously do not like it. They hate it. They thought it was boring. One person said that they accidentally had pressed the fast forward button on the screener that they got partway through, didn't realize it for 5 minutes.
How could they not realize it?
I think that because it was so static in that particular scene.
Oh, please, please, whatever.
I'm just
so you're talking to idiots who don't want to see Amour in the theater than they deserve to be, you know, idiots. So your polling of people tells you they don't like Amour. Well, let's find out from Aaron Rich what movies.
No. It says that people who watched it at home tend to.
I understand.
Okay.
No, but those are the morons who couldn't be bothered to go see one of the best movies of the year when it was in the theater.
Well, it wasn't playing
everywhere.
Yes, those
are the morons in L.A. who couldn't be bothered to go see Amour in the theater. So they're idiots who don't like movies. If you can't be bothered to go see one of the best reviewed movies of the year in the theater, if you can't be bothered to go see The Master and Lincoln, which I didn't love, but if you can't be bothered to go see The Master and Lincoln and Amour and Argo in the theater, then you're an idiot. And your opinion isn't that important.
Well,
tell them they're idiots.
Well, you're telling them because they're listening, apparently, as I learned just over the weekend when some of these Academy members told me I shouldn't have backed down on Argo.
You know, maybe you're a studio exec and you're traveling all over the world, but I'm sorry. You know, people have to understand that there are movies that benefit strongly from being seen in the theater. You can't enjoy The Master anywhere near as much on a TV or a quiet drama like Amour. It's in a way, it sort of can benefit from being at home, but it's a movie that's so intense that unless you're trapped in a theater and sort of just caught into that moment, that performance, you know, it's easy to stop, pause, go to the bathroom, go to the kitchen, answer your phone, check your text. You know, that's just not doing a really good movie a service. I understand there's a couple hundred movies, you can't see them all, but the ones that are getting the best reviews of the year, come on, give it a little effort.
Well, now, speaking of good reviews, maybe we should get our good friend Aaron Rich on the line. What do you think?
Absolutely.
Well, as I dial Aaron up here, I should mention that Aaron Rich, of course, he's appeared on the show before in previous years, right before the Oscars, usually the show before the Oscar award ceremony. He's a blogger who reviews movies with a strong emphasis on independent and international films. Since coming on the show, Aaron has decided to upturn his life completely, switching from a career where he watched movies on nights and weekends, you know, and heading back. He went back into academia, I suppose, is probably the best way to put it. He's now living a life focused on cinema. Last year, he saw more than 500 movies, He actually never saw daylight, apparently. And Aaron says it was a good year for movies, as long as you mostly ignore, you know, that little town out in California, Hollywood. His writing can be found on the blog All the Movies I Watch. Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So 500 movies, Aaron. Did you actually eat during this time period?
Yeah, you know, it's not that bad. It's, you know, I think it's what? It's an average of, is that 10 movies a week? I guess that sounds like a lot. It's not that bad. It's fun. You know, there's lots of bad television out there that people waste time on. So I guess I wasted time with good movies and some bad movies and I guess bad TV too.
But. So you're like the poster child that they have up at the Netflix headquarters. You're their worst nightmare.
Yeah, no, I mean, I probably, of those 500, I probably got 100 or more from between Netflix discs and streaming. So I break the rules of, you know, the average American sees two movies a year, whatever it is, in the theater. I break that rule.
You single-handedly lift that up to 2.2.
Exactly.
Now, so, you have a list that we linked to on our website about the best movies of the year. Most people think it was not a great year for movies, but when you went back and looked at the movies and found the interesting films, you ended up with 38 films on your list. Was this the greatest year in history, or did you just see a lot of sort of interesting films?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I should say, I mean, we should clarify, the 500 or so is actually all movies, all told. In terms of new movies, I actually only saw 128. So maybe it's not as many. But,
so this is like 25% of the new movies you saw.
Right.
One, that's pretty good.
More old movies, that is movies released sort of any year until 2012, than new movies.
One might might think that you're not very discerning with you know, 25% of the movies on your...
Except what you did was you didn't bother to go see Rise of the Guardians or movies that you knew from Hollywood were just not going to be good.
Right, exactly. I mean, I tried to see mostly stuff that had some sort of interest in them, maybe a personal thing, or, you know, maybe something looks sort of interesting of some, whatever that means. I mean, you know, I think it's a matter of trying to pick your movies better, maybe.
I've done that where I used to see everything that came out, and if a movie made a lot of money, I felt obliged to see it just so I could comment on it. But I've sort of pulled back from that in recent years. Not that you didn't see some of the big movies on your list of the worst.
I saw a lot of the comic book movies over the summer. I actually didn't see, I guess, the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man, but I did see, you know, the Avengers, and I saw the Batman movie and things like that. I mean,
and they're on your list
of the
worst movies of the year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those do make up lots of the worst movies. I mean, I think my worst movie list is very populated by Hollywood stuff. There are only a few arty foreign movies on that.
Well, a couple things. One, at the head here, I mentioned that you've kind of turned your life to academia. You were working for, I guess, at one point, an auction house.
Right,
And I just, for some reason, every time I think of you, I feel like I should be wearing a wristwatch.
That's appropriate. Okay. Everyone knows me as the watch guy, my friends. So, yeah.
And then I guess now you're in academia. I don't know where that is or what country it's in. But
believe me, that's a good question for me, too. I don't know where it is either. I decided that, you know, I was watching lots of movies and somewhat, you know, not knowing what to do with it, aside from just it being a very time-consuming hobby, and decided to formalize it in some sense. So, yeah, I mean, I applied to a bunch of the cinema studies programs, which is sort of film history programs around the country, and got into and started taking classes at NYU. And so I'm now a student, a master's student at NYU, and hope to go on and get a PhD somewhere. We'll see. But it's great.
Has going to movies remained as much fun? I mean, now it's homework.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it is homework and it's not homework. I mean, some movies, I think it certainly helped me in certain cases focus my attention a little bit better when I'm watching a movie, even kind of a crappy movie. I can sort of find some kind of fun element that maybe we studied in class or I read about somewhere a little bit, you know, it sort of makes it a little bit less hobbyish. You know, it's fun. I mean, you know, I'm reading right now about the early creation of the star system, and that's sort of a very, you know, it's a relevant thing today. It's relevant as we talk about the Oscars. It's, you know, why is Anne Hathaway, you know, considered a a favorite perhaps in the Oscars. Well, partly is because of sort of her star status. And, you know, that's something that people, you know, historians have gone back and looked at. When did the star system kind of begin?
I think everybody knows it began with the Big Bang, right,
Michael? Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Well, there you go. And that's the thing. I mean, someone actually has done research and found that it begins in 1914, very specifically. And, like, it begins at a moment when, apparently, when stars started having a life outside of movies that people started, that journalists were writing about, that it wasn't just their on-screen persona, but it was their off-screen persona that became relevant. And that's sort of when it sort of film historians start talking about the star system per se.
Was it Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks, or who was the person?
It was before Mary Pickford, but it was right in that era. I mean, Mary Pickford is, I think, generally considered one of the first stars. So it was right in that moment. Yeah.
Well, and now, of course, it's the complete opposite. We really don't care about their movies at all. We just care about their personal lives.
Right. In fact, still talking about Lindsay Lohan.
To me, is part of what I kind of, you know, hate about movies. And, you know, I guess, as you said, you know, I focus mostly on kind of independent and foreign stuff. Not really because I appreciate them more, but because I just sort of, I just don't care about, you know, who's dating whom and, you know, what did such so-and-so say at a press conference, and, you know, all that stuff doesn't really matter to me. So I'd much rather look at what they're doing on screen.
Well, now on screen, we have, well, we can't go over all 38 movies here, but we have a, well, why don't we go over some of them? Your number one movie of the year was Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, which is a Turkish film by Nuri Bilge Ceylan, a filmmaker I like quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I love that. It's sort of a, it's a cop movie, and it's very long and very slow. It's, I think, 3 hours all told, and it is kind of nothing happens for the first 2 hours or so. It's a bunch of guys driving around in a car in the middle of nowhere.
Trying to find where a body is buried.
They're trying to find a body, but they're kind of talking about anything and everything to pass the time. They're basically bored in the car, and you're kind of watching them, which is kind of amazing. I liked it because I wasn't bored as I watched them talking about boring stuff. I just think, as you know, it's totally beautiful and a really, you know, sort of interesting movie.
I think they're going to use that on the poster. They were driving around being boring, and but I wasn't bored as I watched them.
Yes, exactly.
Actually,
exactly.
I think the pull quote will be nothing happens in the first 2 hours.
Nothing happens in the first 2 hours. And by the way, not much happens in the last hour either. I mean,
right. No, it's not like suddenly action is exploding everywhere.
No. I guess it goes from night to day. So the last hour is sort of in the daylight. Maybe that changes things, I guess.
That's true. Now, at I'm sorry, Michael, you probably
please
would
one. Keep go ahead.
At number three, you have Cosmopolis, which is a David Cronenberg film, which was at Cannes this past year.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love it. I think it's one of Cronenberg's best. I am definitely a Cronenbergophile, and I think it's really great, and I think it's really interesting. And I think, among other things, it very much talks to a lot of the themes that he's dealt with in earlier movies, like Videodrome and Existenz, and kind of future scare, you know, worries about the future, worries about the present. It also, he does technically something amazing with sound that I think, you know, it's one of these things that I kind of always sort of shake my head when something like, you know, the Oscar nominations come out and this movie doesn't get nominated for a sound category, because he does this very interesting thing where you kind of hear sound as if you're listening to it kind of in a bottle. It sounds, it's kind of hard to explain, I guess, but it sounds, you kind of don't hear the sound outside of this car that you're in, and you kind of only hear the sound inside the car. It's very interesting.
Yeah, a majority of the film takes place in a limousine. The movie stars Robert Pattinson. It also deals with the financial crisis as well, so it's very timely.
And Occupy Wall Street and things like that, yeah. And I think Robert Pattinson's great. I'm not a big fan of his. I don't think he really is a great actor, but he's great in this.
Well, are you a fan of Gael Garcia Bernal? This weekend, his new movie, No, just opened up in New York. It was the highest per screen average of any film in release. It's a Chilean film about political advertising that he stars in. And one of his movies, The Loneliest Planet, is number 5 on your list.
Absolutely. I am a fan of his. I actually would have seen the movie this weekend, but I'm going to see it next weekend. I think Loneliest Planet is a really beautiful film. Interestingly, I actually saw it on demand, which is sort of my other kind of the other fun thing about my list this year, is that I think of the top 10, I think I saw two or three of the movies on demand at home. I mean, this is an absolutely gorgeous movie. Looks great on an HD television. And the movie, I think, is just, it's beautiful looking. And I think it's really amazing that it all kind of hinges on one very, very quick, fleeting moment that one could miss and think the movie is not very good. But if you catch this one little moment, it sort of really changes everything. And it's a beautiful movie.
Well, at number six, you have Django Unchained from Quentin Tarantino, also nominated for Best Picture. But number 10 is an interesting film. A lot on a lot of people's best of lists this year was Holy Motors, a film by Leo Carax, which was one bizarre film, yet somehow amazing.
Yeah, and by the way, another movie taking place in a limousine, just like Cosmopolis, so maybe that's a theme. No, I think Holy Motors, I mean, Holy Motors is clearly sort of the film geek's film. It's really a movie about movies, I think, and it's which is why I think a lot of kind of movie reviewers and all like it is, you know, but maybe it doesn't so work so well for everyone else. But very interesting, very weird. It has a kind of, it creates a little formula and then repeats that formula throughout the film. This guy kind of is dressing up and playing roles in people, in the lives of people he meets. He's sort of acting out characters in their lives. And it's very cool and it looks great. And
those people have paid him to do this.
Right. It's as if he's sort of a spy. It's sort of as if he's like, you know, Mission Impossible and he's getting a case to kind of go and work a job on somebody. But the job is kind of being somebody's father in one scene or being a homeless man who robs somebody in another scene or, you know, things like that. It's very strange, really interesting.
Well, I think what's interesting about your list is that in days gone by, if we saw a list like this in the New York Times or the New Yorker or Film Comment, and we didn't live in New York City or we just missed the movies when they were in theaters, we thought, oh, God, we lost our chance. But a lot of these movies, I think, even though they're pretty obscure, are probably available on DVD, on Netflix, on streaming. They're out there, yeah. And people could look at your list and see almost all these films, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that there is one film I know is not on DVD and played only at the Anthology Film Archives in New York, which, you know, I apologize for being a elite snob something because, you know, that's a horrible.
Is that Planet of the Snail?
Actually Allmire's Folly. Planet of the Snail was played at Film Forum for a bit. I don't think it's on DVD. That's a Korean documentary about a 7 foot tall deaf and blind man who's married to a sort of 3 foot tall, what are they called? Little person.
Yes.
This wonderful kind of odd couple. And it's really wonderful.
I think Zac Efron is doing the Hollywood remake of that.
Exactly.
My problem with that movie was that, it was just so slow.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I like slow. I think maybe that's my thing. I do like slow. I mean, or something. I don't like slow and boring, but I like slow and weird.
Well, I haven't seen the film, so I didn't know that it was slow. I just, you know, Planet of Snail,
I assumed. Oh, no, yeah. It's a slow movie. There you go.
You also have some other favorites on here. The Kid with a Bike by the Dardenne brothers at number 12. And then at number 14, Rust and Bone by Jacques Audiard, which opened recently in the United States. A lot of people liked that film as well. You know, what strikes me is at number 21, you have two Steven Soderbergh films, Haywire and Magic Mike. And it just dawned on me, he's released 3 movies in 1 year.
Right. Well, or 2. But I think the Haywire and Magic Mike were 2012. And then Side Effects is 2013, no?
Yes, but I mean, within 360
within 12 months.
I see. Yes, correct. Yes, of course.
No wonder the guy wants to retire. Yeah, he's tired.
I think 2012 was a really great year for Soderbergh. I think it's a shame that Magic Mike became this sort of crap fest that people were seeing it because it was gay or because it was about strippers or something, because I actually think it's a really fun, smart movie. It's a really good genre movie. I think he's been doing these sort of interesting genre pieces for the last 2 years, and I like them. I think they're really fun. They're really small. Haywire is a really, I think, sleek kind of 60s European action movie. Magic Mike's a really fun kind of, it is trashy, but I mean, it's sort of trashy on purpose. It's, you know, I wouldn't hold it against the film. For what it's worth, I think Side Effects is a really great Hitchcock update, a really great movie that just came out recently.
So do you see any trends or things coming up in 2013, or what are you looking forward to other than perhaps midterms and doing your term paper?
Well, no, I mean, I pay attention to what I hear about from different festivals. I certainly listen to Showbiz Sandbox and get my start making a list of movies I want to see. There's a lot of stuff, you know, coming out soon that played at Cannes last year. It's hard to put my finger on any in particular that are specific. I mean, I'm looking forward to, what's it called? Beyond the Hills. Is that the one? The Romanian movie?
One of my favorite films from that last year. Yes.
Yeah. I think 2012 didn't have a single Romanian movie in America, which was a surprise because actually 2011 had a ton of them. And so maybe it just runs in cycles. We need more Romanian movies. There were a bunch of Greek movies last year and not a lot of Romanian movies. So,
well, I would like to point out that you have a couple of movies on here that I liked. Footnote, I know, Michael, you like that film as well, by Joseph Seder out of Israel. Elena at 31, which is, how would you describe
Russian.
It? It's a Russian film about...
Sort of Hitchcockian.
Yes, very. Yeah. A really good movie. Then one that I've never heard of, Beasts of the Southern Wild. Is this a movie that got any play, or where
exactly.
can we find it?
Well, and I was actually... surprised when I went to see it that the score was co-written by Ben Zetlin and a friend, the brother of a friend of mine. So I guess I have some sort of little personal connection to it or something. But I think it's a really kind of wonderful movie. I know people don't like it. I know there are people who think it's kind of too sort of twee or sort of, you know, it doesn't tell enough of a story that matters. I think sort of the way it tells a story is actually quite beautiful. And I like it. I mean, I generally don't go in for sentimentality, and I think it certainly cheats a little bit to that side, but I think that sort of it's just the way it tells the story is really beautiful.
Right, and it's about a father and daughter living in the bayou, literally in the bayou. I mean, they're living in trees, literally. Moving on, I see 34, How to Survive a Plague, a documentary about the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and 90s, and that's nominated for Best Documentary.
Yeah.
You can't really make fun of the Oscars, because on your list is Django Unchained, Argo, and Beasts of the Southern Wild, as well as How to Survive a Plague. So you've got some movies in competition at the Oscars. Argo,
absolutely,
if it
yeah,
wins.
Totally. I mean, it always happens to me that there's sort of at least one of my top 10 is almost always nominated for Best Picture. Last year it was Tree of Life. And, you know, it's sort of, those are generally the kind of the ones that don't have a chance of winning. But, I mean, certainly Argo, which is, what is that? That's my number 35.
Yes.
You know, certainly has a good chance of winning. But, you know, I guess it's more, I make fun of the Oscars more when they give awards to, you know, sort of the crap that I don't like very much, like Les Mis.
Well, now, how do you rank these films?
How do I rank them? Like, what's my process? Or what
yeah,
do you
I mean?
Mean,
like, why is, you know, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia above Holy Motors, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a matter of what sort of what I remember and kind of my process methodologically. I keep track of movies as the year goes along and give them stars and ratings and sort of keep a general sense of a list. At the end of the year, then I'll sort of compile everything. And, you know, that's why this year has, 38 films in it. And some years only have 20 some, because this year I actually did think there were a lot of worthwhile movies. You know, that Once Upon a Time in Anatolia is better than Holy Motors certainly has something to do with kind of how I felt about it, like how it emotionally connected to me, what I thought of it sort of, again, sort of technically and formally. And I think there's some amount of wanting to not seem like every other critic out there with a list. And, you know, maybe a movie like Holy Motors, it's probably unfair, but I'll admit it, that a movie like Holy Motors might fall slightly down the list because it was so popular and on so many other lists. You know, a movie like Anatolia, which was on very few lists, or fewer lists, you know, maybe gets pushed up a little bit because of that.
And you just mentioned Les Mis a moment ago. And
yeah.
That it seems like you really, since you're mentioning it, must really enjoy it, because
exactly. No, that was my worst movie of the year. I have to admit, I've never seen the Broadway musical. I've actually never even read the book, although I'm certainly aware of the story. But I thought the movie sort of made no sense as a story. It made no sense. I mean, sort of, it was one of the most incompetently shot, directed movies I've ever seen in my life. It was, you know, everyone's talking about the close-ups, which I'm, you know, sort of all the characters are singing in close-up, which I was actually less offended by than the fact that when you shoot someone in close-up in a widescreen format, you end up with a lot of kind of space next to their face.
And nose hair, by the way, I might
add.
And
nose hair, yeah. And so, like, every scene had this sort of gray kind of blank area next to it that could have been used interestingly but wasn't. And I just think that, who is it, Tom Hooper? I just think he can't direct his way out of a paper bag.
Well, I was actually grateful that half those shots were out of focus.
Well, there you go. Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, I also think it's funny. Everyone's talking about how special it is that it was, you know, sung live, which I think is a ridiculous thing. I mean, that's like crediting some movie because, you know, it uses color. It's like, that's not a thing, you know, I take for granted the process of shooting it. That's not a, I don't know, it's not, that's not why we go to a movie. It's, you know, it's, yeah, I don't know. I think the movie's a big mess.
Well, to give you some sense of how many movies you have seen, Aaron, and I know you know, but for our audience, on number 13 of your worst movies of the year is a movie I saw at Sundance starring Paul Dano called For Ellen. And movie was, you know, it wasn't good. It has one scene in it that is a classic when he's in the toy store with the child. He plays a rock star dad who wants to bond with his child. And finally, and it's just so.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a bad movie. And actually, I think the director, So Young Kim, Korean director, I think is really fantastic and has made a handful of amazing movies, including In Between Days and Treeless Mountain, which were in their respective years, two of my favorite movies from those years.
Same for me.
But this didn't work at all for me.
I'm just surprised that you were even able to see it.
Oh, no. I mean, that played at Film Forum. I mean, you know, I'm lucky in New York to be able to have access to art house movie theaters, but it did play. It played for a few weeks, actually, I think.
But you're far from perfect because we have a link to your list and then we have a link to my current list for the best picks of 2013. And there are some movies on your list I need to see, but I know you've seen three of the top four, all the top five films I have, but three of them somehow are not on your list. Not Amour, not The Miner's Hymns, and not The Master.
I think The Miner's Hymns is really beautiful. Again, I guess this goes back to when you're asking me about my method is I think it didn't sort of connect to me as well emotionally. And I think it, you know, I really do appreciate what he does in general, his process. And he takes this sort of old found footage and recontextualizes them. I also feel sometimes like a movie like that almost falls more into kind of an art film category than I don't know what to say. An entertainment,
like a museum piece
film.
Rather than a feature
museum
film.
Piece, yeah. Which is, I mean, there's no reason why such a movie couldn't be on my list, but maybe when I'm thinking about it, I guess I downgrade it for that reason. The Master, I think, is really interesting. I think it's beautifully made, and I think it has some of the better performances by some of those actors in it. I guess I felt after seeing it that it kind of didn't leave me with much to kind of pull apart. And I think ever since Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson has sort of disappointed me a lot. And I feel like this is probably his best movie since Boogie Nights, which I think is his best movie. But I don't know. It leaves me a little bit cold.
You didn't like There Will Be Blood either.
I really didn't like There Will Be Blood. And kind of for similar reasons, which is that, you know, he tells a story in a really beautiful way and kind of almost kind of a polemical way. He's kind of yells at you about the story and, you know, but then when you're done with it, you sort of say, so what? That's what I keep on always coming back to is I sort of say, so what? And I don't feel like there's an answer to that a lot of the time with his movies.
And I have one question about Amour. Did you see it in the theater or did you see it at home?
I saw it in the theater.
well done. At least you gave it the time and energy to see it on a big screen, because there are movies that just benefit from being seen in a movie theater, don't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, that's the, you know, it's a shame about a movie like Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. Oh. I feel like I had a much better experience seeing it in the theater. It takes place so much at night that I think just the physical surroundings of seeing it in a theater, in a dark theater where sort of gradations of darkness matter, it doesn't work as well at home, where you're going to have the window open and different amounts of light, and it might not work as well. You know, that's the thing. I mean, I guess it's the same thing can be said about 3D movies when you're watching them at home, not in 3D.
Aaron, you know, if it means anything, I actually, in the 90s, went to NYU, and one of the degrees I got was from the cinema studies program there. I was in the cinema studies program myself, and look at me now.
There you go. So there's a future for me in podcasting and journalism.
Yes, be prepared to make nothing.
Two gigantic industries where people make millions of dollars.
So much money. And I apologize, we've taken you away. You could have seen another third of a movie while you took the time to talk with us. So we thank you for, you know, taking time out of your movie going to speak with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was actually very nice of Aaron to join us again. You know, it's actually a nice little benchmark for your year to kind of figure out, you know, what movies you've actually been able to see, because he sees way too many movies. I mean, he just sees all of them.
Well, he doesn't, though. There's a lot of Hollywood movies he doesn't see. But there are so many more movies available now. There are like 700-800 movies commercially released. He only saw about 130 of current new releases. So he didn't see, I'm sure Roger Ebert and other top film critics who have to see 3-4 movies a week, they saw more new movies than Aaron did. But he is focusing on independent and art house cinema. And there's so much more of that available. And you don't have to be there at Film Forum to see them. You know, you can catch movies on DVD. You can catch movies on streaming. And hey, it's better to see them more at home than it is to not see it at all. So, you know, I should say that as well.
We'll place a link to his story, as Michael said, in the show notes. On our website, showbizsandbox.com, and really take a look at it, because there are some movies on that list, not the worst of the year list, but the best films of 2012, according to Aaron Rich, that you really should see.
Absolutely. And if there's on both of our lists, that's probably an even better bet. You know, if we both recommend something, it's a good shot that if you're into independent or art house cinemas, you're probably going to like it.
And so what you're saying is Argo, Beast of the Southern Wild, Michael, Rust and Bone, Attenberg, The Deep Blue Sea, How to Survive a Plague, Footnote, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, Django Unchained, and that's it. And the Miner's Hymn.
Well, that's not on his list.
Oh, it's not on his list. Okay.
But yeah, those are all movies that are on both lists, and they're certainly an eclectic mix of independent cinema.
Well, I watch most of my movies on Hulu this past weekend, but also on YouTube.
And do you watch any music videos while you're watching them?
Actually, that's all I watch on YouTube. I was kidding around about movies on YouTube. I'm sure there are movies on YouTube, as we've reported here before. But let's face it. I mean, these days, YouTube has turned into this generation's MTV.
That's true. And it's not just for new music videos, but it's for stumbling across new talent as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's where Justin Bieber was found, right? I mean, so... Mm-hmm. And a lot of this new talent is doing cover songs or covers of popular music, of songs that, you know, Maroon 5 or the Red Hot Chili Peppers, or you name it, you know, that other artists are doing, specifically Adele. You can find a ton of Adele covers on YouTube.
Well, you can find anything, but I have a couple of young people who are really good. They're good guitarists or pianists or singers, and they regularly put out covers of songs, and I'm just waiting for them to get picked up by a record label. I mean, they really seem to have the talent and the skill, and I think they're building up a fan base, and I think it's just a matter of time before another one of them crosses over into popular success.
Well, this is, I mean, we're kind of segueing into this story here about how Vivendi, or I should say Universal Music Group, which is a part of Vivendi, and it's not the music group per se, but it's the publishing group. They have struck a deal, according to the Wall Street Journal, with Maker Studios and Full Screen Inc. And if you don't know who those are, they are what is referred to as multi-channel networks, or MCNs. And these are networks that they either produce their own content, and they'll produce several shows. So like Revision 3 will produce like 5, 6, 7 shows of their own. But they also go out and they find these videos that are either on YouTube already or about to be posted there that they think can go viral and that they could help promote. So they try and take a video that wouldn't otherwise be seen by as many people and try to get more people to see it. Now, Google, of course, loves this because, you know, they own YouTube, and they like to see these MCNs promoting use of YouTube and for people to visit YouTube. They love this. A lot of the content, or at least some of the content that Maker Studios and Full Screen was promoting for others
was, is, and are. It's amateur video.
Yeah, it's all amateur video, but they're cover videos.
Right. They're kids who do a cover of the new Adele song. They cover Skyfall, they cover the new Justin Bieber tune or whatever it might be.
Right, correct. And well, part of the issue with that is that the copyright owners, the people who own the lyrics and the compositions, that's the music publisher, in this case Universal Music Publishing Group. They're supposed to be getting paid, and they weren't.
Right. It used to be in the old days that if somebody put up a cover of a song, they got pulled down, or somebody would try and pull it down if they noticed it. In other cases, if people ran a wedding video and they put a pop song over on the video, then that too would get pulled down. Now what they do is they put an ad on it, they put a link to buy the song that's being played in the video, and they monetize it. They make money off the views. So if somebody's wedding video or somebody's cover of a song actually hits and gets some views, everybody makes a little bit of money.
Right. And in this case, the money, it gets given to some of these MCNs because they're the ones that posted the video. The MCNs...
They didn't post it, though. I don't understand why they would get
the money.
In
some cases, they're the ones that posted it. In other cases, they're promoting it and they've taken it into their network.
And so they've made money off of this video.
They've made money off this video.
They see a video on YouTube. They Michael Gilt singing The Doors, Riders of the Storm, and I'm really good at it. They take my video and they start promoting it on their network. They haven't asked me for permission. They haven't done. They're just linking to my video somehow, but they're making ads, money off of it, and monetizing it somehow.
No, they've usually asked. They're usually working with the video creators. It's not. They don't just take your video. They're usually working directly with the video creators.
Really? They're calling up some kid going, can we take your shower song?
Oh, yes. That's exactly what they do.
Because YouTube just says a thing. Once you hit a certain number of hits, they send you a thing saying, hey, do you want to put ads on your video and make money off of it?
Right.
And it's not some automated thing. It's like them calling you up.
Yes. And it's not
really?
YouTube calling you. It's these multi-channel networks who have people that like troll YouTube looking for videos they think can be popular.
So they were doing this, they're making tens of millions of dollars, and they weren't paying anybody any money.
Well, we don't know how much they were making. I can't speak to how much they were making. But certainly, according to the Wall Street Journal, and according to Universal Music Publishing Group, the chairman, Zach Horowitz, he says here that he first approached the multi-channel networks because he had noticed how much online exposure they were generating for his company's songs, which is very true. They do generate a lot of interest in, you know, look at Call Me Maybe. I mean, there were more covers of that song than the song.
That was done by Maker Studios or Full Screen?
No. Meaning well, that...
Don't credit them for that. Though.
No, I'm
they
not crediting them.
With that. That was done spontaneously by thousands of different people all over the world.
Right.
So again, it happens, but don't credit these guys for it.
Right. What Horowitz says here is that, and this is a quote, I'm thinking I've discovered this great way of tapping into all this money, he said, and instead I find out we're not getting paid.
Okay, I think this story is so confusing and stupid to me. These people were there on the side. They spot some video that they like. They pull it into their network with the person who created it permission. They make money off of it, but they never bothered to pay off the publishing. So like you're covering, for example, Call Me Maybe, but they're not paying Carly Rae Jepsen or the songwriters any money for what they're using it. So they're making money off this song without benefiting the person who actually created the song. So the studio finds out about this, Universal Publishing, and they go, hey, what's going on here? Instead of suing them, demanding money, having a full accounting of all the money they've been ripping them off of, because they're supposed to pay them. They're not allowed to do this.
Right. Well, they're supposed to pay ASCAP. They're supposed to pay the mechanical royalty.
They're supposed to pay people, yes.
Yes.
They're not paying anybody.
Right. And so
instead of suing them, they've made a deal with them.
Right. Instead, what they're saying is, hey, instead of paying ASCAP, the mechanical royalty, which you're supposed to be doing, pay us directly instead.
So they can't go around the laws of publishing and royalties. They can't supersede that.
Well, they could.
It's a separate deal. It's not that they're suddenly not obligated to make whatever payment they have to make.
Yeah, no, they're still obligated to make those payments. You're absolutely right.
Right, right. But okay, whatever. So it's this stupid companies nobody has heard of making money off of it. And instead of suing them, they've made a deal with them. That's what this boils down to.
Yes, there's a lot of stupid people apparently, according to you this week.
Well, why do we care?
Why do we care? You know, it's one more way that people, rather than fight YouTube, are actually trying to figure out a way to work with YouTube and these new forms of distribution.
Not distribution, but new forms of creativity, I guess.
Yeah, creativity, distribution, promotion.
Right. It's just one more possible revenue stream where artists and songwriters who've watched CD sales collapse might actually make a few pennies back.
Yes. I mean, I'm getting the sense that you could care less about this story.
I could care less about this story. I think it's a big whoop.
Ooh, okay. Well, then I guess it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about the Department of Justice. So the Department of Justice sued...
Talk about stupid.
Well, they sued five of the big six in publishing. And so five of the big six publishers were sued by the Department of Justice, and they interfered with the deals that they made with Apple and others. They interfered with how they price books and interfered with the competition and diversity this brought to the book marketplace. Before those publishers went to bat, Amazon was dominating the ebook business to a monopolistic degree. Afterwards, there were more players competing, more competition, and prices were back to levels where people could make money, rather than the lost leader sales of Amazon preventing anyone else from competing, which is effectively what they were doing. Nonetheless, the DOJ, Department of Justice, interfered and sued to influence all these areas. But when the two biggest publishers in the U.S. decide to merge, the DOJ sees no issue with the combined forces of Random House and Penguin and clears it without objection. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It's unbelievable. It's the two biggest publishers in the U.S. combining to make an even bigger publisher, and the Department of Justice said, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
They have nothing to say about this. They don't see any potential problems with this. They don't even have a symbolic, well, you got to get rid of this, you know, Albanian publishing subdivision you have, because that would just too much dominate that particular market. Nothing. They have said nothing. They're like, it's the biggest merger in publishing history in North America. Whatever. We're fine with it. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know, they certainly fought AT&T and T-Mobile here in the United States from merging because they felt like that would limit competition. We'd have to read their report, but apparently they must not believe that this would limit competition because anybody can go publish their book today.
But that's absurd, though. You know, the two biggest people are going to dominate the market even more. To say that it's not going to limit competition, you couldn't find an agent or an author who would agree with that. Not one.
Right. I wonder, you know, who they used as expert witnesses on this. It would be interesting to find out.
Yes.
Well, it certainly wasn't Superman.
Okay, there's a segue.
That's right. Is Superman a homophobe? That's what fans are wondering after DC Comics announced a new digital anthology of short comics called Adventures of Superman, with sci-fi writer Orson Scott Card on board. Card is famous for his Ender's Game novel, a classic work beloved by teens that has spawned numerous sequels and still sells strongly today. Card is also a Mormon and infamous for his virulently. That's the word I meant to say. He is Mr. Anti-Gay Politics Man. He just, you know, he's the anti-gay guy. No one blinked an eye when Card was involved in comic book spinoffs of the Ender's Game world he created, but the announcement that Superman would be penned by a far-right activist sparked an online petition to get DC to recant and not align the Man of Steel with bigotry and prejudice. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's just a digital online anthology of short comics. It's not the lead Superman series. It's not the principal driving franchise of the Superman world. There's lots of different little Superman books and lines and storylines and things like that. But it's another interesting example of online activism and how people can get together, bring attention to something, announce a petition, get some action. DC is already feeling a little heat. So that's kind of interesting to see how that works. You know, you can't do things quietly anymore. And it did spark me to sort of look up and go, gee, where is happening with Ender's Game? Why hasn't that been turned into a movie? It came out back in, I think, 1985. And I looked it up and it is finally filmed and it's coming out in November. It's been a long time waiting for Ender's Game.
Well, you know, I think Superman is, he's kind of more aligned with truth and justice, right? Not bigotry and prejudice?
Generally.
Yeah, okay, just checking. DreamWorks Animation would like to be the next Disney. Thank you very much. They've already got a theme park planned for Shanghai and have different lands, i.e. attractions, in the Universal theme park in Japan based on Madagascar and Shrek, as well as rides at Universal theme parks in Florida and Hollywood. Now they've got their eye on Russia, where DreamWorks Films have proven incredibly successful and popular there. They plan three indoor entertainment zones in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and How do you pronounce that, Michael?
I'll put on my Russian hat. How the heck would I know? Yekaterinburg.
Yeah, what he said.
It sounds like a place where you send political exiles. That's all I know.
Yeah, well, these are cities with 11 million, 5 million, and maybe the reason we haven't heard about it is that particular city that I can't pronounce, 1.5 million people population, respectively. The parks will include movie and concert halls to retail centers, hotels, and immersive, interactive environments with DreamWorks' most beloved characters from films, including Shrek, Madagascar, How to Train Your Dragon, and Kung Fu Panda. What about Stallion of the Cimarron or whatever?
Nice.
You know, Prince of
Spirit
Egypt.
Spirit of the Cimarron. Yeah. Spirit of the Cimarron, yes.
Exactly. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It sounds like a big whoop. They don't sound like theme parks so much as malls.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
they really,
exactly right.
They're indoor entertainments, and they're going to have stores and movie theaters and some more stores and maybe a ride. They sound very low rent. Because if you think about the cost of a ride at a major theme park, it could be easily the cost of a major motion picture, $100 million, $150 million easily to create one of those big roller coasters or major rides at a theme park. Well, you're going to build three theme parks in Russia. Countries aren't very close together. These cities are pretty wide apart. I'll give you that. Nonetheless, that seems like a lot of theme parks. But when you read the description, you find out that they're basically glorified malls. It sounds like a very low rent move on their part, as far as I'm concerned.
Speaking of low rent, and we will be talking about DreamWorks Animation during Inside Baseball in a moment, but it looks like DreamWorks Animation is going to be cutting up to 500 employees, so they may be trying to figure out some way to make money, any way to make money, really.
Yeah, but low rent in your most valuable properties is not the way to do it.
You know, well, look, Rise of the Guardians, we all know it underperformed. Mr. Peabody and Sherman moved. And these are two movies that they're working on. Well, no, it's one movie. Mr. Peabody and Sherman is a single film. They moved that to 2014. The in-development film Me and My Shadow has gone back to the drawing board, so that's back in development. Or to be more blunt, they made Kung Fu Panda 3 overseas to save money. So is it a big deal or a big whoop? This whole, you know, DreamWorks laying people off, and they could have possibly made you know, kept some of those jobs if they...
I think that was a little confused. Yeah, they have 2,200 employees. They're going to fire about 500 in the next few months, almost one out of every four employees. And they were trying to come up with reasons. And Rise of the Guardians wasn't that big of a flop. It made just roughly about double what it cost. So it's not going to be a moneymaker for them, but it's not going to lose their shirt. They've got movies in development that they're struggling with. That's okay. You go back to the drawing board. That's a good sign, because you don't want to just go forward just because it has momentum. That's what Pixar does. If something's not working, you rip it up and you start over again. So to panic and say, oh, we got to fire all these employees, the real reason is that they said Kung Fu Panda 1 and Kung Fu Panda 2 were both made in the U.S., wildly popular worldwide, huge successes. They've got theme park lands devoted to them in Shanghai and overseas. It's one of their biggest properties around. Kung Fu Panda 3, they're going to make it overseas and fire U.S. employees. So it seems pretty straightforward that they're just trying to save a buck and letting all that talent that they developed over the years that could help them create more movies down the road be on the dole. So that doesn't help them. You've got to keep your employees working long-term and create that talent that where you're going to nurture the next big writers, the next big directors, the next big illustrators, the next Frank and Ollie. You know, you've got to give people consistent work for years and decades to develop that sort of talent, and they're not doing their job.
I would agree with you in large part, everything you just said there. I think that the reason that they're making Kung Fu Panda 3 in China, at least in part, is because if it's a Chinese co-production, we all know how those films open in China with no competition and the Chinese government helps protect the release.
And that's a very short-term decision.
Well, possibly. Speaking of the short term, this past year, movie ticket prices were up in 2012. The seemingly constant refrain of the business, by the way, movie ticket prices going up instead of staying steady.
Or entertainment business, frankly. Movie ticket prices, concert ticket prices, cable subscription prices, it's always going up.
Right. Well, the average movie ticket price hit an all-time high of $7.96 here in the United States, thanks to IMAX and 3D. And of course, the format that both Michael and I appreciate most, LIMAX or FIMAX, it's the fake IMAX, and all those other premium movie watching experiences that ask you to pay extra for good picture and sound and force you to buy 3D when you'd rather not. However, there is a belief that actual ticket sales will also have risen perhaps some 5% more than 2011. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
What's a big deal? I think tickets went up like 3 or 4 or 5 cents. The 3 cents per ticket from 2011. That's not even keeping pace with inflation. So that's a good sign. I mean, ticket prices are always going to rise a little bit, but when you keep it down to 3 cents, that's a pretty good deal. Frankly, I'd love to pay $7.96 for a movie ticket. Haven't done that in years. I live in New York City, and we don't get away with less than $12 or $14.
Well, I would love to, and I've been advised not to put this survey together, but the National Association of Theater Owners puts out this report that gives the average ticket price for the country, the United States, and I think North America. I should say North America, so U.S. and Canada.
Yeah.
And they say it's $7.96. Well, at least in 2012, it was up from $7.93 in 2011. However, that is taking every single movie theater and every single ticket price into account. That is not the effective rate, in my opinion. I think the effective rate is far higher, and that if you were to look at where people are going to the movies and the number of people going to movies where the ticket price is higher, the effective ticket price would be much higher than $7.96.
I don't understand.
Meaning the average takes into account places that are have
like $2 drive-ins.
Yes,
or something?
Exactly. And they might be in a
but they only sell like 1,000 tickets.
Right. So if you actually do a weighted average, the effective ticket price will rise.
They're not doing a weighted. They're counting the $2 paid for a 2-for-1 discount movie in Oklahoma the same as if
I believe
they're just
so.
Average. Really? I can't imagine. Wow, that seems really unlikely.
And when I have suggested in the past that somebody should do a study and that I might do it myself of the weighted average, everybody, at least on the exhibition and distribution side of the industry.
Shut up, they
yes,
say.
Exactly. Since there's a reason they do this, the NATO does this study the way they do it.
Oh, very good.
Well, you know, maybe then you won't have to pay as much for this next film, The Canyons, because insisting he always saw his new movie as a multi-platform release. Director Paul Schrader says he's thrilled that The Canyons has been picked up by IFC and will get a theatrical and a VOD release day and date. So you can see it at home or in theaters, depending on where you live. That's no surprise, since the movie has been a button-pushing experiment from the start. It has a script by Bret Easton Ellis, and of course we all know who he is, the author of Less Than Zero and other books. It stars Lindsay Lohan, who made news for her on-set behavior. In fact, did you read that New York Times piece? Yikes.
I did not.
It co-stars an adult film star named James Dean, going legit. It was partially crowdfunded by Kickstarter, or through Kickstarter. It did some casting online and presumably had its own Twitter feed before the script was even written. So it would have been a shock if The Canyons had not had a 21st century release pattern designed to make the most out of the flurry of attention it might get upon opening without the expense of a wide release. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay.
Movie gets picked up for distribution.
Okay, then this next one. I turned to Twitter over the past week, and there amongst some of the trending topics was Chubby Checker. And I thought, oh no, did Chubby Checker die? That was my first thought.
You'd be upset. You'd be heartrended that.
I mean,
I wouldn't be happy that he died, but I was sort of, my first thought is, oh, was he alive? You know, I mean, God bless him, but I'm sure he's got to be 70, 80, 90 years old.
I have no idea. But I was surprised to find out why he was trending.
Okay.
I'm going to say this, but Come On Baby, Let's Do the Twist could take on a whole new meaning soon, unless rock and roller Chubby Checker has his day in court. He's suing the makers of a new app that used his name. You might think a Chubby Checker app would be some sort of weight loss program, maybe. But not exactly. In fact, the jokey app is supposed to let women guess the size of their potential dates. Well, you know. Presumably using guesses about hand.
You know?
You know.
What? You can't say the word? It's okay.
It's a children's program.
They use the medical term. It's all right.
Genitalia.
Yes.
Penis.
There you go.
Presumably using guesses about the hand and foot size. The urban myths, as I like to say. Checker trademarked his name in 1990.
Urban myths? Do you have small hands?
I don't know. No, I'm just wives' tales. I couldn't think of the other,
What's your shoe size, Sterling?
I believe I'm a size 12. I don't know what that means.
Keep going.
Checker trademarked his name in 1997 and is suing the developer for irreparable damage, even though the app only had 84 downloads, and has since been removed from the Palm Operating System App Store, otherwise known as the what? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. He's 71 years old, so there's no reason Chubby Checker can't be twisting for many years to come. I apologize for that. He's sort of a one-hit wonder. He did have a couple other hits. I mean, a few, including another number one single called The Pony. But obviously, he's best known for The Twist. And frankly, I'm surprised he hasn't used some sort of weight loss program or, you know, fat pinching thing and, you know, used his name that way. But he should be in charge of his name. I'm surprised he waited until 1997 to trademark his name.
I know, exactly.
Good Lord. But, you know, his heyday was back in the 60s and 50s when nobody was thinking of that at all. It was 50s, right, for The Twist? Well, that was 1960. Was the year that that hit number one. And it went back onto the charts again and again. And he had other spinoffs like Let's Twist Again. And even charted to number one a year later. Slow Twisting was another hit of his. You know, he'd made everything twisting around the world. The guy did everything with the twist that he could possibly twist it up.
That's twisting another the hit night away? Twisting
yeah.
the night, yeah.
No, that, yes, yes. Twisting around the world. You know, if you could say twist, by God, you know, he would make the most of it.
Well, I will say that at 71, he may not want to be doing too much twisting. You know.
Hey, now 71 is the new 50.
Well, you know, look, Lady Gaga had that accident on stage, and now she has to have hip surgery. She's canceling her tour.
That's right. So it is important that you wonder, why is he suing? The app was a flop, and it shut down. But you do want to protect your name and establish the fact that you have been defending your name. So sometimes you say, why is he suing? Well, sometimes you have to sue just to make clear you're defending your name, because if you don't sue and establish that you're defending your name, the next person can come along, use Chubby Checker, and say, well, these other people did that, and you never sued them. And so you've set the precedent that it's up for grabs.
And that is actually precisely how you're supposed to guard your trademark, as they say, or protect your trademark. Yes.
Well, so good luck with Chubby Checker. I hope he's twisting for, you know, another 10, 20 years to come.
And does not break his hip like Lady Gaga.
No.
Yes. Well, that's all kind of very technical and inside baseball. So we should probably move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business. And more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're going to go back. I remember, Michael, in a previous episode, maybe 1 or 2 weeks ago, you said, gee, I wonder how we're going to know if House of Cards over on Netflix is good. They're not going to release any ratings. So how will we know? Well, apparently you're not going to, because Netflix says, look, we're not releasing any numbers because we don't have any advertisers. We don't have to. At least that's what they say. However, I guess who was it? It was Ted Sarandos, the chief content officer over at Netflix. He was speaking at D-Dive Into Media Conference here in California, and he says, I don't want to give ratings because it's a real apples-to-oranges comparison with network ratings, but we're thrilled. And he says it's the most-watched program on Netflix right now.
It's number one. I should hope it would be number one. For God's sake, they spent $100 million on it, so it better be number one. You know, it's like saying the number one show on CBS. Well, you know, it better be. HBO got away with this for many years. They just would not release information. You couldn't find out what was going on or what their shows were, how many people were actually watching their shows. They just said, oh, they've got a lot of buzz. We're happy. But eventually they had to cave in, and now you sort of get those overnight ratings. You get the figures on HBO series right away. And I think eventually Netflix needs to play that game too. It's a different world. It's not ratings, obviously. It's how many people are watching.
Right.
But you know, they're going to be there out on their own. So they're setting the standards. So they don't have anything to compare it to or be worried about, you know, unless, you know, a 5-year-old episode of Two and a Half Men is getting more views than House of Cards on opening weekend. That would be a problem.
Yes,
but,
it would.
But basically, there's no reason why they should, unless they think it's proprietary, I think they should let it out. It's always better to give the actual numbers. You're not fooling anyone. If it's a disaster, you're not going to do it again. You're going to do it differently. Just let them know what the numbers are. Say, hey, how many people watched, you know, I'm sure the numbers are fascinating. The first episode, they're probably trending down. You know, but on the other hand, maybe 80% of the people who watch the second episode watch all 10 episodes. You know, who knows how it's working out? Who knows how many people are watching? They're not helping anyone by not talking about the numbers. They're just sort of creating a fake sense of mystery that just leaves us all, gives us less to talk about. If they really want to, you know, get people talking about the show, the best thing they can do is say, hey, 2 weeks in, look at the numbers now. People are still joining the show. They're still watching the show. That gives people another chance to write about the show and talk about it. By not giving the numbers, they're not helping anybody.
Well, Ted Sarandos does not agree with you. He says that when you say 10 million people watch a show, that really doesn't tell you anything. However, he does agree with you on this, that they are, and this is Netflix.
It tells you 10 million people watch this. What does he mean? It doesn't tell you anything.
Well,
of course it tells you something.
Let me finish.
It tells you how many people watch the show.
Right, but what he says is he wants really big data. And by that, he means he wants to evaluate who is watching it, how they're watching it. And in fact, Netflix has not one, but 10 different trailers for House of Cards that they show to their subscribers.
Big deal, fine, okay.
And they show it to their subscribers. The way they pick is based on what you've watched before. They have all these secret algorithms to show you the trailer that best fits.
Well, yeah, please.
You.
You're a woman over 30, they show you one trailer. You're a guy under 20, they show you another trailer. It's not rocket science. 10 seems a little bit much. But right. Yeah, but the point is, we want big data too. It does tell you something, how many people watch the first episode and then watch the second and watch the third. It'd be interesting to see how many people consume the episode gorging, how many seem to be coming back and watching two episodes and then two episodes and then two episodes. You know, we want the big data too. So
yeah,
and
yeah,
he's not,
I mean,
making the show more popular by lying to us or hiding the figures.
But
that doesn't make the show a bigger success. Hiding the numbers does not make it a bigger success.
But in all fairness to Netflix, their model is not the we released it on Sunday night. And I have to agree with Mitchell Hurwitz and Will Arnett, who complain, and they're with Arrested Development, both the creator and one of the stars, saying, look, you know, people didn't watch Arrested Development the same way that they watched live television. They would put it on DVR and watch it later. And during the time that Arrested Development was on Fox, the Nielsen did not count those ratings. And I think
that's exactly why Netflix should be releasing its data and figures so we can see how people are consuming the show. That's absolutely true.
But let me ask you this.
They didn't watch Arrested Development the way they did others. They're not going to watch House of Cards because they released all 10 episodes at once.
But they spent $100 million on this program.
And they're not going to make it a success by hiding the numbers. That's not going to make it more successful.
If it's successful, the way...
We'll never know.
If it's successful, we'll know because they'll do it again. But if it's successful, the way and manner in which it was successful, why do they have to share that? That's not necessarily information that they should be sharing with potential competitors.
Potential competitors like what?
Like, well, look at Amazon. Amazon has Instant Prime just this past week. They mentioned that they're going to be, I guess, streaming CBS's Under the Dome, not only... eventually, they're doing it while the show is still on the air. So this is a mini series based on a Stephen King book. 4 days after it airs, they're putting it onto Amazon.
That happens all the time. Then they're not creating the show. That's CBS. CBS is showing up on reruns on Amazon Prime, just like they do on Hulu, some people, or on their own network website. Okay. So that's not a competitor. Amazon Hulu is not suddenly spending $100 million on a mini series. The fact is, we can't believe you until you give us the numbers. Until you tell us what's happening, we're not going to believe, oh, it's a great success. Right.
Well, before somebody writes in, because I know somebody's going to do this, yes, CBS has been the last to like go online and to give their content to Hulu, and they usually do older series. They've given all these old series to Hulu and Amazon. So more than likely, you're not going to see current episodes on any of these services.
That's true. They've done a runaround of Hulu. They're going to Amazon first.
Right. Exactly. So that's the big news there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess going back to Netflix for a second, they're continuing this trend of original programming. They're working with guess who? DreamWorks Animation to create an original kids animated series. It's going to be based on their new film Turbo. So it's kind of a tie-in. And
movie doesn't come out until later this year. Or even 2014, does it?
Yeah, I think maybe the series will debut in December in the United States and then 39 other countries that Netflix kind of offers its subscription service to. I don't know when...
it comes out this year, later this year. It's voice characters by Ryan Reynolds and Paul Giamatti.
Okay.
Oh, no, that can't be it. Is it? It is.
It's a whole bunch of hack actors, basically.
Okay, very nice. it comes out in July 19th. A freak accident might just help an everyday garden snail achieve his biggest dream, winning the Indy 500. And actually, that's kind of funny because it's good timing because at the Daytona 500 this week is, of course, the first woman to ever win pole at the Daytona 500, Dana Kilpatrick, who might very, has a shot at winning the Daytona 500, breaking down a big barrier, so Turbo could not be more timely in a way.
Right, because, of course, Danica Patrick, a snail herself...
She's not a snail, she's a woman, and she's making breakthroughs in a male-dominated sport.
I thought this was, you know, equal rights for snails today, since we talked about snails earlier in the show. But that kind of brings us to our listener email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
And if you want to send us an email about the numbers on Netflix's House of Cards experiment, we'd love to get them, and we won't reveal who you are.
When people ask not to be revealed, we don't reveal them. In this case, we have a first name, at least. Randy from Los Angeles. Do you want to read this, Michael?
Okay. Hey, kids. Yes, I've been listening long enough to know exactly how to address you when writing in. Besides your podcast, keep up the great work, by the way. I'm also a fan of The Walking Dead. I haven't watched last night's episode. This is Michael talking. I hope he doesn't tell me the plot. Anyway, he continues. Your explanation of how the show begins each week with 2 minutes of murder and mayhem was hilarious and spot on. I wanted to call your attention to a recent study that says the show, The Walking Dead, that is the most deadly show on television. I believe it. Here's the link. It's from funeralwise.com, Fall 2012 TV Body Count Study Results. It says the deadliest show on television is the AMC series The Walking Dead, with an average of 38 dead bodies per episode and representing 20% of all dead bodies counted in the study.
Oh, my God.
Of the dead bodies on The Walking Dead, 91% were zombies. So, in fact, they were technically already dead to begin with. Guns were the deadliest weapon. Gunshot victims comprised 44% of all deaths observed in the study. The next closest identifiable cause of death was the knife or blade. The undead faced different hazards. The primary cause of death differed for humans and non-humans, that is, zombies, vampires, etc. Humans died most frequently, 52% of the time, from gunshots, while for non-human victims, the most frequent cause was knife, as in a blade, knife, blade, arrow, or various other means. Wow, funeral-wise, that's fascinating. We'll have to check out the website. It says, keep up the great work, Randy from Los Angeles.
Well, and I appreciate you writing in, Randy, especially for saying keep up the great work, not once but twice. And I put on all those bullets. I could have added another 10 bullets. That's how long this study was. I mean, it went on and on and on. Who came in second? It was very funny. And so it was a nice little, I never would have seen this study, by the way, ever. I don't even know how they do this study. We should probably get Funeral Wise on to ask them. But I never would have seen it. And I appreciate, Randy, you letting us know about it. Now, as I mentioned, Randy wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. At the head of the show, I mentioned we also have a phone number you can call where you can leave us a voicemail. The number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
Yeah, when we mess up, let us know.
Yes, which that's probably, you know, we're never going to hear from anybody then because we don't mess up. See?
Okay.
Well, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, Stitcher, any podcast aggregator where they give away podcasts for free. We urge you to rate and review the show on any one of those sites or podcast aggregators. It really does help us out. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us in iTunes or Stitcher. Also where you'll find ways to follow us. We are on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox. We also have a Facebook page, which can be found under the username showbizsandbox. Again, everything is on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has an ever-evolving, ever-changing website of his own, which is this week, Michael?
ChubbyChecker.com.
ChubbyChecker.com, which he will now be sued for. So, actually, if you really want to read some of his writing, you can go to michaelgiltz.com. And if you want to read some of my writing, you can go to celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice. Well, that was a quick one.
Really?
No. Is it ever?
Oh, well.